So now it's my pleasure to introduce Clayton Christensen. He is the Robert and Jane Cizik Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School, and he has a joint appointment in the Technology and Operations Management and the General Management faculty groups. He has a BA from Brigham Young University, a master's degree from Oxford University, an MBA from Harvard Business School, and a doctorate in business administration from Harvard Business School as well, where he has taught as a faculty member since 1992. In 1982, he was named a White House Fellow, where he worked in the Transportation Department with Secretaries Drew Lewis and Elizabeth Dole. And notably, he was a missionary himself for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Republic of Korea from 1971 to 1973. He currently serves his church as an Area Authority 70 and recently published an essay about his beliefs, which I believe we link to on our website, entitled Why I Believe. Today he'll be talking to us about Mormons in American politics. We're delighted to have you.
Well, thanks, Eric. I'm honored that you'd come. Eric suggested that I take 20 minutes or so just to share some thoughts about our religion and its role in the political scene. And so I'll try to do that, and then hopefully that will be a foundation for your further questions. I thought of first... Some of you are probably more informed about our church than I am. But for those who aren't, it might help if I just laid a foundation of at least who I think we are, and why is it that a group of people like us could think of ourselves as deeply committed Christians, and yet in the political controversy be accused of not being at all Christian. So I'll do that, and then I'd like to give my view of what true religion really is in an attempt to separate people who carry religion as a banner to power and people who truly practice religion. And then I want to recount a profound experience I had that helped me frame the role that religion has to play in a democratic society. And then finally, given that role, talk a bit about the posture of our church towards political involvement and what I think may be productive and unproductive roles that religion can play there. And then just open myself up to whatever questions or cannons you want to shoot at me. So, a bit about who we are and why we are framed as not Christian, and all I can do is talk from the Mormons' perspective. So, but our sense is that after Christ's apostles passed away, that there was some inevitable drift in the posture of the church, both in terms of the doctrines that were taught and the practices, and as the church grew through the Mediterranean, they bumped into lots of opposing philosophies. And it created conflict and compromise in the church. In 325, they convened a council in Nicaea to try to hammer out, we've got all of these conflicts going on, so what's really our orthodoxy going to be? And they agreed on this creed that's known now as the Nicene Creed. And then they convened again in Constantinople 70 years later and revised that. But that creed kind of defined what was orthodoxy in the Christian church. And then the church continued to evolve through the Middle Ages, and then Protestant reformers recognized that there were things about it that ought to be changed, and so they, in protest, they founded their own church. But all of them continued to anchor themselves, the definition of orthodoxy, to the Nicene Creed, and that definition of what is the Trinity and other things involved there. And so then how Mormonism came onto the scene was in 1820, a young boy in New York was trying to figure out, of all of the Christian churches that were competing for the attention of his family, which he should join. And so he simply went into a grove of trees and prayed, and God and Jesus Christ descended from heaven. and told them that they wanted to restore the original church, that with its doctrines and practices that had been established by Christ, and called him as a prophet. And in the process, helped him find another record that we call the Book of Mormon, that was written by a set of Israelites who at the time Israel and Judah were being scattered, were led to set up a duplicate civilization in Latin America, where Guatemala and the Yucatan Peninsula now are. And they continued to look forward to a Messiah and have prophets amongst them who received revelation just as they did in Palestine. And so this other book of scripture called the Book of Mormon emerged. And Mormon was just one of the prophets who condensed all of those prophets' writings into a single book. And the reason I think that many Christians view us as being outside of the group is that we actually, even while most of Christianity centers itself on those creeds, we don't. We center ourselves on what we believe were the teachings in the first century. And so by their definition, we're not Christian, because there's a definition of Christianity that's implied by that orthodoxy. And so that's a very simple view of why they say we aren't and why we say we are. I had an experience when I was going over to Oxford to do my first graduate degree. Another fellow who was on our scholarship asked me a bit about Mormonism. I was the first Mormon he'd ever known. And missionary-minded as we are, as soon as we got to Oxford, I found a copy of the Book of Mormon and took it over to Andy and gave him a copy. Two days later, he knocked on my door and gave me the book back. And I said, Andy, I didn't mean to loan it to you. I just wanted to give it to you as a gift. And he said, I don't want it. He said, I don't know who your PR firm is, but you know that story about God and Jesus coming down from heaven and appearing to a young boy, and then his getting this new record out of the ground and translating it into another book of scripture? You got to put that in the back of the book. Because I just can't get past it. And he said, it's probably the most incredible story I've ever heard. Incredible as in no credibility, rather than amazing. And it really sent me for a loop, and it made me wonder, is it an incredible story? So on my next reading of the Old Testament, I just made a chart where I characterized the calling of each of the Old Testament prophets. You know, what were the circumstances? How old were they? How was it done? And it turns out that a whole lot of them were young boys when they were called. Samuel was a boy, David was a boy, Jeremiah was a boy, and so on. And then another part of the pattern was that God, it seemed like people found it a lot easier to believe the dead prophets than the living prophets. You know, so they followed Moses out of Egypt, but they really didn't view his teachings as they didn't accept it. They built a golden calf. And while they revered Abraham as a prophet, they rejected Moses. And then by the time Isaiah and Elijah and Jeremiah came around, they threw them in jail. But they'd gotten used to the idea that Moses was a prophet. And then by the time Christ came along, they killed Christ, but they'd gotten used to the idea that Isaiah and Jeremiah had been prophets. And so the fact that we claim a prophet has been called in our day and nobody believes him, it probably lends credibility to the story. Because in our day, just as in times of old, people had a hard time accepting that. So that's just who we are and why I think we're viewed as a cult in a non-Christian church, even though from our point of view, it actually is a very credible story. So now, my view of what religion and its role in politics might be. I read an article a while ago, and to show how much better a scholar Alan is than I didn't write the source down. So it was either Atlantic Monthly or The Economist. But remember when the Chechenian rebels seized that elementary school a few years ago and killed several hundred of these young people there? This journalist had worked her way into the leaders of that rebel group and interviewed the chief honcho. And it turned out that this guy, in the 1960s, had joined Che Guevara in Bolivia and fought with him. And the journalist, quite fascinated that he'd come from that background, asked him, geez, what was it about communism, and especially the Castro Guevara brand of communism, that so captured your fancy that you go halfway around the world? And it turned out the guy knew almost nothing about communism. So then that kind of faded away, and he shows up next in Chechnya as the head of this radical Islamic group. And she said, well, what is it about radical Islam that so captured your heart? And it turned out the guy knew almost nothing about Islam. He's just a really rotten guy. And he wanted to do mean things, and it was just a lot easier to do what he wanted to do if he had a banner that he could carry while he wreaked havoc. And given that, I've looked at some of the leaders of what's known as the religious right in America, and especially the political side of those people. And Ralph Reed, who was such an articulate leader of the Christian Coalition, turns out he siphons away millions of dollars as part of the Jack Abramoff scandal. And Newt Gingrich was having an affair even while he was prosecuting the impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton and preaching family values. And Tom DeLay resigned in a scandal that has many dimensions to it. And I just think there isn't anything religious or right about a shocking number of these leaders. They just needed a banner to hold while they sought power. And it's an ancient problem. There wasn't anything religious about the behavior of those involved in the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition. The pilgrims tried to escape persecution in coming here, but as soon as they got here, they turned around and persecuted people who disagreed with them, like Roger Williams. And turns out that many of the behind-the-scenes leaders of the Ku Klux Klan in the South were Protestant ministers. Indeed, a lot of those who led the mobs that drove the Mormons out of New York and Ohio and Missouri and Illinois before the Mormons found their way to Utah also were Protestant ministers. And there isn't anything about those who strap bombs onto young people and send them off to blow up innocent people in the Mideast that's at all consistent with the teachings of the Quran either. And I don't need to go on. I just wanted to recount these sad facts to urge us not to be fooled by somebody who carries the banner of a religion into a conflict. And similarly, I don't think that we ought to allow their actions to cloud our understanding of what pure religion is. And I hear so frequently somebody says that more people have been killed in the name of religion than any other cause, and it simply is not true. The people who kill in the name of religion are really practitioners of no religion. And so what is true religion? Well, Christ gave us a litmus test, and actually this was taught to me by Mitt Romney when he was in our church we don't have professional ministers, and so individual people have to take responsibility for different functions in a congregation, and we call the person who runs a congregation a bishop. And it's a little bit lower in our hierarchy than a Catholic bishop would be. But Mitt was the bishop of the Belmont congregation at the time. And I remember that he taught this lesson. He said, you know, Christ, he offered a litmus test for how to tell somebody is one of his disciples. And it's in the Gospel of John 13 and 35. Christ said, "By this shall all men know ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another." And he didn't say, so you can tell that this person is my disciple if they believe in this set of doctrines, or if they keep the Sabbath day holy and limit the number of steps they walk on the Sabbath. But he said, no, here's the way you tell. If they have love one to another, they are my disciples. And in another place, the Apostle James said, pure religion and undefiled before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and widows in their affliction, and to keep himself unspotted from the world. And elsewhere, Jesus said, ye have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. Earlier, God said, thou shalt not kill, commit adultery, steal, or bear false witness. And I would assert that when we see people whose behavior matches the pattern that's described in these scriptures that I've read from the Bible, you're looking at true Christians. And that's the litmus test that Jesus asked us to apply. And when we see someone waving the banner of any version of Christianity whose behavior does not conform, then it's safe to conclude that he or she are charlatans. They've flunked the very litmus test that Christ himself established. Now let me say two things about the role of religion in democratic society. These are two separate stories. The first one, Eric mentioned that I had a chance in the early years of the Reagan administration to be a White House fellow. One of the great elements of that is every week, two or three times, you get to have lunch with a prominent player in the federal government, either present or past. So our group of White House fellows got to have a four-hour lunch with Richard Nixon in the fall of 1982. We decided we weren't going to ask him any questions about Watergate, it was too near and painful. But I asked him to go back to 1972 when he made his decision to open diplomatic relations with China. And at the time, it was a very controversial step, as you may remember. China was an arch enemy. We were in the middle of the Vietnam War, unable to extract ourselves. And so I asked him, what was his thinking behind doing that? And he said, well, you know, from the time I lost to Kennedy until I got elected president, I had a lot of time to study. And so I studied the history of America's foreign relations. And I observed that whenever our policy had been to isolate a totalitarian state, that isolation only proved to strengthen that state and give the dictator the privilege of vilifying America for all of the problems that his mismanagement of that country created. And whenever America's policy had been to open up interaction with the totalitarian state, first a diplomatic interchange, and then cultural and educational, and ultimately economic interchange, it always had weakened and ultimately destroyed the totalitarian government. And he said, I decided that from 1949 to 72, Mao's communist government in China just kept getting stronger and stronger and stronger as we had tried to isolate them and bring them to their knees through isolation. And I decided we just had to weaken his government. And what subsequently happened is really quite profound, that one of our most mortal enemies was destroyed without ever killing anybody. And where America's policy continues to be isolation, Cuba, North Korea, Myanmar, Iran, and Iraq, the totalitarian governments just got stronger and stronger. And that's had really quite a profound impact on me, because I think, although Nixon was not a religious man that I could discern, in many ways, his attitude towards how you end conflict really was the kind of policy that Christ would have taught, and that is to love your enemy and do good to people who despitefully use you. Another story. There was a Chinese Marxist economist who taught at the University of Tianjin named Gao Leyong, who came here on a Fulbright scholarship to study democracy and capitalism of all of the arcane topics. And we got to know him very well during the year that he was here. And Chris, my wife, invited him and his wife to our home for dinner just before they were leaving. And so I asked Dr. Gao, of all the things that you learned about capitalism and democracy while you were here studying, was there something that was just really surprising that you had not anticipated learning before you came? And without any hesitation, he said, yeah, I had no idea how critical religion is to the functioning of democracy. And I've never put these two things together in my mind, but it's like this guy flies in from Mars, and this is what he sees. And he said, you know, you guys are like fish swimming in water, you don't know it's wet. But it's very clear to me that America today is living more on momentum and culture. But in your past, almost all Americans went to a church on a Sunday or a synagogue on a Saturday, and they were taught there by people who they respected that they should voluntarily follow all the rules and obey the law. Because even if the police didn't catch them, God would. And he said, because most Americans, most of the time, voluntarily obey the rules, democracy works. And he said, there's a critical set of rules that are codified in the Christian scriptures. They're Judeo-Christian scriptures, and he quoted some of the New Testament rules, or some of the Ten Commandment rules. And he said, it's not any religion, but it's got to be a religion that has the power over the way people behave, and they've got to set these rules. Like, you don't steal other people's stuff. You always tell the truth. You respect their life and their liberty as you respect your own. And because most people do that, democracy works. But if you look around the world, he said, where America has just snapped its fingers and said, I want democracy right here, and I want it right now. If they don't have a foundation of a religion that influences the way people behave in this way so that they voluntarily follow the rules, all you get is a complete breakdown in social order. And he pointed to Haiti as an example, or to Russia as an example, where without that foundation, democracy simply cannot work. And that really had an impact. Because it helped me see how critical the role of religion is in a democratic society. And when we have institutions in our society that try to push religion off the public stage, saying that the framers of our Constitution intended to have that separation, what they don't realize is that by trying to minimize the role of religion in public life, they're trying to minimize the very institutions that give us our civil liberties in the first place. And it's just made me really proud to be affiliated with a religion that is busy at work putting into place that foundation. And now the last set of thoughts about the political activism of the LDS Church. There are only two types of institutions where these principles or these rules that Professor Gao talked about can be taught with power that is sufficient to guide behavior, and that's the church and the family. And I think this is a wonderful role that religion can play in political life, and that is to aggressively try to establish this foundation. And so in our church, as you know, we spend extraordinary effort, given the size that we are, to teach religion around the world. And I served in Korea in the early 1970s, when Korea was just a desperately poor country. And when I finished my service and subsequently lived out here and in England, quite often people would say, "So what did you do as a missionary?" And I'd say, "We taught people about Jesus Christ." And they'd say, "Why are you doing that in a country that was just so desperately poor? Why wouldn't you instead try to administer financial and welfare relief?" And I've come to realize, no, really by teaching people about who God is and that they should always be honest and never steal and respect other people's freedom in their lives, we really were laying the foundation for extraordinary freedom and prosperity in a much more permanent way than we would have had I joined the Peace Corps or something like that, not to minimize what they do. But I decided that teaching religion around the world is a wonderful contribution to democracy. And one of the benefits of that in our church is that, you know, you always develop a love and a loyalty to the causes for which you have suffered and sacrificed. That's why BC has such a loyal alumni base, I think. But the result of it is that as the Mormon Church has sent its missionaries around the world, when we come home, we always leave half of our heart in the country that we served in. And so half of my heart's in Korea, half of our children's hearts are in Germany and Mongolia and Idaho and Taiwan. And as we come back, really nowhere in America do you have a world view like there is in the LDS Church. The other institution that is able to teach these principles as a foundation of democracy is our families. And as you know, strong families is a very, very important priority in our church. And every week in our worship services, after the main service, the mothers go in one room and the fathers go in another. And a key element of every discussion that we have there is, how can I be a better husband and a father and a better wife and a mother? And then on Monday evenings, we reserve that to teach these principles to our children. And we really do work in that way. And really, until I prepared these thoughts at Eric and Alan's invitation, I hadn't thought of those things as political activism. But I kind of decide they are. For example, gambling. This is a big political issue in Massachusetts now. But you know what? It would not have arisen as an issue had the churches that Governor Patrick and the casino developers attend done their jobs and taught their adherents that gambling is an evil thing. And so now the churches have to get together in a last-ditch effort to stop that from a legal point of view. But where the action really needed to be taken was in our homes and in our churches, in teaching the evils of things like that. We have a welfare system. Every Sunday, or once Sunday a month, all the members of our church fast, and we save the money that we didn't consume on our own food and donate it into the church's welfare fund. As a result of that, if someone in the church finds themselves in financial hard times, they lose their job or they can't support themselves, they don't go to the government for welfare assistance, they go to their bishop, who then dips into the funds to help them. And then the bishop organizes a group of members of the church to rally around that person and help him or her stand on their feet so that they can support themselves. And if somebody joins the church who has been receiving public assistance, our policy has been to get them off of public assistance and to support them with the church funds so that we can then support them in that way. There are other churches that do similar things, and Catholic Charities does wonderful things. But I think this is political activism at its Christian finest, and that's what we do. And I think I could summarize our political posture by saying, if we really did our job in inspiring our members and in inspiring other people who live with us but are not of our faith to live Christianity as Christ defined Christianity, we would preempt many of the political issues that now require political activism on the part of so many. And that's really, I think, our posture towards political involvement. So those are just my thoughts, Eric. I'm sorry to go on so long, but
this is wonderful. Thank you.